This podcast episode is powered by AfriPods, the world's number one podcasting platform for African stories.
Hi guys, welcome to yet another episode of the Offshore Investor in the Kenyan Wall Street. My name is Ali Mukanino and I will be your host today. So in the last episode with Roy, we talked about the introduction to offshore investment, and we discussed the different requirements for opening an offshore brokerage account, including things like your national ID, a utility bill for your address, a passport, and how you can navigate around getting the different details. We also talked about the advantages of investing offshore, such as the price movement, as well as the fact that you can buy percentages of a stock as compared to a whole stock if you can't afford it. So we have Roy on the show again, and today we want to talk about the different types of brokerage accounts which you can access, the platforms where you can invest offshore, and some of the myths and misconceptions of investing offshore. Welcome to the show, Roy.
Thank you very much, Ali. It's always a pleasure to be here.
Okay, so right on.
So today I think we'll start maybe with the article that I saw on Business Daily. The article was gross savings hit record low on mega returns. The article is done by the Kenya Institute for Public Policy Research and Analysis, KIPRA 2020 report. And what it shows is the gross savings stood at 761.1 billion as of the end of 2018, a sharp decline from 907.4 billion in 2018. In recent years, such a low gross saving was last recorded in 2002. It's a long time ago, about 18 years ago. Right. So they say the low returns on savings act as a catalyst for people to save less and cash out on their savings and opt to hold their cash in assets with better returns. Now, they continue on the same article, and the overall low savings is driven by a lack of alternative to bank deposit culture. That's the culture Kenyans have. The bigger the bank deposit, the better. But the problem with that is there's no return. You're getting from having a big account. Yes, the money is there and it's quite liquid. You can go withdraw it, but it's not working for you. It took time for you to actually make that amount of money. You should at least, on worst case scenario, have two people working. Now you have the money that you worked hard for. It should do the same just for you, because you'll need to take care of you later in your years. That will be your retirement nest saving. So a lack of better product offering from well-regulated and reliably executed service providers has left retail investors with very limited options, save for the anemic stock market, almost non-existent corporate debt market, and almost no foreign exposure. And that's where we mostly, I think, come in. You find that retail investors have no clue what is going on about the offshore market, right? And this article comes just behind the same thing that Zamara said. They said you find most pension funds as well have not put enough funds into offshore section of the investment, despite the fact that it was the highest return segment of the pension funds, right? There's a big problem. So that tells you that in Kenya, either the information is lacking or people don't know. Like, for instance, if I wanted to go invest offshore, where do I go to? Who do I talk to? Where exactly? There's none.
That's exactly where we come in.
Exactly. So I think that's something we'll be changing step by step. Hopefully it gets to the right people who will take action and maybe look to learn more about how the offshore works, and maybe look to, even if not go 100%, have a bit of the portfolio in there. Maybe 20% could be 20%.
Most people decide to stash their money somewhere, either in a mobile money wallet or in a bank account, as opposed to bring the money out there to invest locally or internationally.
So what I think is we have is, financial literacy is quite, is something big in Kenya. Just because you have money does not necessarily automatically means, you're financially well off, or let's say financially educated, right? First of all, every time you have money somewhere under the mattress, there's something called inflation, and it never stops, right? So you have 1,000 now, inflation was 10% this year, means as you begin, you're already 10% below the following year, right? Because your money is not worth what it was last year. That's because of inflation. So you need to have your money working for you. If worst case scenario, at least at par with inflation. So essentially, you have the same buying power next year. But the ideal situation should be that you'd be having a better buying power than you did last year. So if the inflation was 10%, you did 20%, you made on absolute basis about 10%. So you're better this year than you were last year.
When you save money in a bank account, some bank accounts do accrue interest, right? Why would you still encourage someone to decide to invest their money when you can still have interest? Rather, where do you decide, you know, that the returns on investing in my savings would give me money that would outpace inflation as compared to the returns from the interest in my bank?
Well, it used to be like that, right? So they used to pay 3% until Parliament pulled the plug, right? Nowadays, they don't have to pay you anything. To them, it's free money. So you're giving the bank free money, and that's what they're doing. The cost of funds is way low, so you're giving them money to work. It's like me bringing you cash and telling you, okay, Ali, here's money. Whenever I want to withdraw it, I'll get it. But I never withdraw the total amount. I probably withdraw 20%. You still remain with that with 80% of my cash, and you can do whatever you want, and you do not have to pay me anything. So the lack of knowledge on how money works is a big problem that we have. In Kenya, the biggest part goes to one, either starting a business. Success rates are quite small, right? So in a 5-10 year frame, you're looking at 90% of businesses probably don't exist anymore. The second option is land, and that has pushed the prices of land out of, you know, very few people now can afford land, especially say in the Nairobi area. It's quite expensive. And you're looking, what will you do with that land? Say you bought land for 10 million, right? You will need to sell it in 2020 when there's a pandemic, and you want to be liquid as fast as possible, and yet you find there are no buyers. Lack of alternative and information has pushed people into not putting the money where it should be, working for them better.
When you talk about land, of course, I mean, there are other costs that come with buying land, for example, things like landlords that you have to pay.
Yep.
And whatnot. Does investing offshore also come with other costs that I would call unmentioned at first? Because when you go to buy
land,
no one tells you about these things.
They don't, yes. For offshore, no. Once you have an account, the account is under your name. You don't have anything other than just buy and sell stocks anytime you want. You're not taxed, you know, as a non-US resident. Your capital gains are zero rated, right? So you don't have any tax to pay on that. Your dividends, on the other hand, will be taxed at 30%. Well, that is automatically. They will do that electronically, so you don't have to go filing with the US government or the IRS, which is the Internal Revenue Service, which is equivalent of our KRA here. You don't have to file anything with them. Interactive Brokers or whichever broker you'll be having, they will do that automatically for you. I would say there are no hidden charges, if I would put it in a better way. Give or take, if, for instance, in this year, if you just had your account, you'd be up 8% because, you know, the Kenya shillings has lost about the same just in 2020 against the dollar. So you've done nothing, you probably didn't invest anything, but your amount was in dollars and you've gained 8%. I don't think it's a bad thing at all.
That's about it.
All right. Okay.
So you've mentioned the different accounts that a person can open. Can you go deeper into what brokerage account options they are buying and what's their difference?
All right, so you either an active or an inactive investor. So active is you consistently looking for information that is both affecting your stock directly or indirectly. And that could be from different sources, depending on where you're looking for them. Online is the biggest, of course. Secondly, we have the financial statements from the company. There's also industry reports that come from different sources. And that would be somewhere you want to learn more about both the industry and the company where it stands. When you're active means you are continuously monitoring your portfolio, right? Most people don't have that option, especially despite you probably having made money from maybe business, maybe from investments as well, or could be anything. You might not be very conversant of how the stock market works. So this is where you get managed accounts come from. So you can have your account managed either by a broker, you could have it managed by a private entity, for instance, hedge funds. And that would be a great way for you to make money. Even though you don't understand the nitty-gritties, you still could make a good return out of it. So managed accounts, it's simply you having your account being managed by somebody else, right? So for instance, I'm a managing partner of Bricklink Capital LLP. We do that. So we could manage your account on your behalf, despite the fact that the account is under your name. The agreements to sign and, you know, we do give you that option to get to know what we are all about. But that is the option that inactive traders have. Secondly, they could also buy into ETFs, which is the exchange traded funds. So exchange traded funds have a variety. They do track commodities, could be stocks, indices, anything. So how to find this will be, you still need somebody who's well acquitted in this, but those are the two options you have. You either get your account managed, that's number one. Number two, buy into ETFs or the exchange traded funds.
Don't have a managed account. All right. I have a few questions, yeah? All right. I understand the Capital Markets Authority in Kenya was monitoring the different funds that were making decisions that didn't quite augur well with the investor interests.
Right.
How does that play out when it comes to offshore investments? Rather, how much control does the investor have with regards to where the manager puts his money?
Well, the amazing part about managed funds is you get to learn and to see everything that you have, right? So I could be managing your account, but you have access to it anytime, any day that you want, right? So you will be able to see which stocks you own, how much cash you own. You don't necessarily even need to call us. You will see it on your end, right? So you can do it using your phone. You can use either your phone or you can use the computer. Any device that is internet accessible, you'll be able to do that. So the transparency that comes with it is much better. For instance, in Kenya, if you invest in a unit trust, you don't necessarily know what they're buying, you know, under your name. You just know your money is there. You put in maybe 10 million or 2 million or whichever amount is, and you do not have a day-to-day analysis of what is going on, right? If you want to go exit, you just simply go and tell them, I need to exit. That is different when it comes to offshore. Offshore, you have a separately managed account, which is Ali has his own account, but Ali does not understand how the ongoings of offshore investing work. So Ali will want somebody to manage the account for them. So they go, they look for a fund, could be, you know, Bricklink, could be any other hedge fund out there or any manager out there, and they attach the account to that manager. So the manager has the capability to buy and sell, but the account management is under you. It's under Ali. They first cannot withdraw that amount. That's number one. Number two, you are the one who will be, for instance, if you have to pay them, depending whether it's a management fee you agreed on or a performance fee, you have to be the one who's doing it.
Does it go deeper into the difference between the management fee?
All right, so management fee, normally it's paid whether you make a profit or not. Not always the best. Why do I say that? Because it's a lazy way to make money. It's a really lazy way to make money as a fund manager, right? This is because whether I make a profit or not, I get to get paid. This is automatic. It doesn't matter. It could be 1% or 3%. In Kenya, they charge for unit trust, they charge 3% management fee. And this doesn't matter whether they make 2%, whether they made 20%, the management fee kicks in. Even if they don't make any money for you, by the way.
So it's not that they're managing the investment.
Yeah.
You need to pay.
You need to pay them. Now, there's a difference when it comes to performance-based fee. So performance-based, as it simply says, is you have to perform. So you have a hurdle rate. A hurdle rate is simply like a watermark. Okay, like let's say Roy and Ali agree that an amount above a certain hurdle rate, it could be 8%, it could be 2%, It could be any percentage that you agree, and you say, above this rate, I'll be charging maybe, for instance, a performance fee of 20% of profits. So this is on a profit basis, not on total assets under management. So if you make 20% and you had a hurdle rate of 8%, so you get to get, or you get paid the 20% management fee of the profit alone. So that would work because that pushes the manager to think different. Secondly, it makes them be very cautious because they understand if I do not make above 8%, I'm not going to get paid.
So the only way the manager makes money is if I don't, and so we both make money together.
Exactly. So we're in the same boat. So I make sure that the boat keeps on, you know, sailing as safe as it possibly can. Because if I don't make money, that means I don't get paid. If Unitrust, for instance, went on the performance basis, most of them in 2 years they'll be closing shop. It's just the way it is. It's a difficult way to make money because you need to work. You need to be very good.
That I'm on the advisory side, it's a good way for you to make money because I have to work for that effort to make sure that you make money, I make money.
From the management, the performance team, do we have a standard rate? You know, we have an industry rate, or is it something that's bespoke where the investor and the manager always have to table?
All right, so how you simply calculated is you look at the risk-free, right? So you want to know over a long-term period of time, how has the risk-free performed? So the risk-free is the 10-year bond of any country, could be Kenya, could be US. So the average for US, for instance, for the last maybe 100 years is 4%. So now that's, you know, that there's no risk there. If you invest, you get 4%. So you want to get something above the 4%. So what you will find is, there's that premium that they will put on top of the 4%. So they might put like 2% above the 4%. So that means the hurdle rate will be 6%.
Right.
They might also put 3%, meaning the hurdle rate will be around 7%. The maximum is normally double that. So you find that will be around 8%. So that will probably be the highest you'll find. So above that, then the performance fee takes effect. That would be the best way to do it.
So essentially, you're saying that ideally in a situation where the risk-free investment rate is around 4% and we put in
a premium on top. Or
a
markup is the same thing. Precisely. So it's the same thing in Kenya. You find that the average could be, it's around 12%. So maybe 12.1%. You don't need to be a genius to buy a government bond, a 10-year government bond. So what would be the hard rate above that? So you're looking anywhere above 13% if it's going to be 1% above the markup, or maybe 14%. Hence, I'm saying if, for instance, Unitrust pushed into that direction of performance fee, they might not be able to be in business for long. Because, you know, you need to get paid eventually. And if you keep underperforming the benchmark, which is the risk-free at 12%, then you're not doing much, are you?
Could you please translate it to, you know, layman's terms? So when you say that the hurdle rate is 12%, what does this mean for a layman investor?
All right, so there are two ways to invest. You can invest in a bond, you can invest in equity. Now, equity by nature are riskier, especially if you're looking into bonds, the government bonds. They are more riskier than government bonds. So you want to be paid a higher premium. The riskier it is, the more you need to be paid for that. You just don't take risk for nothing.
So the higher the risk, the higher the return.
Exactly. That's exactly what you need. So if I invest in a government bond, the understanding is I will get 12%. So they pay twice a year. So you pay 6 months and then at the end of the year. So that is standard. They will pay you 12%, of course, less the withholding tax and the rest, but average will be 12%. So if Ali is looking to invest, he's found, you know, Bricklane Capital as a fund manager, and you tell Bricklane, okay, now I can make 12% of government bonds, but I need to take more risk, and I need you to do that on my behalf. So what do you think would be a markup above what I'll easily get from a government bond? So we'd come to an understanding, which would be anything above 12%. So it could be 13%, 14%. And then I'll tell you above that hurdle rate, then I will price my performance fee because I perform better than the bond. Automatically, then I get paid when you get paid. So if I don't make 14%, even if I made, say, 11%, that is free money for you. I did nothing that year, so I don't get paid.
Oh, so it's like the hurdle rate is some sort of like a minimum threshold.
Exactly.
Of returns that you're supposed to make for you to make money.
Yes.
You're in the business, of course, so
yeah.
I have to point out the conflict of interest. But anyway, what would you say is the likelihood of an average fund manager to hit the hurdle rate? What has been the normal range of returns in offshore investments in Kenya based on your experience in the world?
They've performed better. Not that they do very well. Most of the hedge funds actually underperform the S&P 500. And, you know, that has its repercussion. So most people move their money from hedge funds because they were charging both the management fee and a performance fee. When ETFs open the door for a lot of them, they just move their money from hedge funds into ETFs. This is a reaction to the charges. And over time, you find that, you know, most of these hedge funds have reduced the prices. If anything, some of them are actually going into ETFs themselves. So you find they charge maybe a management fee, which is anywhere below 1%, but they still perform very well, right? So that has been the repercussion of not being able to meet your hurdle rate over a period of time. But there are those who do very well. For instance, maybe back in, you know, at his prime, Warren Buffett still is in his prime, but he did have a partnership. It's the same thing. It's just that maybe when he started, they didn't call them the hedge fund. So the hedge fund is, you know, it's an entity that makes money both when the market's going up and down. So you're hedged on both ways, and you make money on good and bad markets. So that's where the word hedge fund came from. And so they were partnership. That's how they all structured. They are all partnerships. So you become a partner in, say, Bricklin, and there's a managing partner, and then there's just a simple partner, a limited partner. So once you become a limited partner, the managing partner manages the money on behalf of the limited partners.
Right.
Yes, and that is individual based. You don't necessarily, it's not like a company where you're board of directors. It's simply where the managing partner has an understanding with the limited partner, and it could be very different. I could have, for instance, an agreement different from the rest of the other limited partners. So
it's bespoke.
It's just, yeah. Not normally bespoke, but it has to be on pen and paper because you have to sign under the dotted line. But so it could be different. We could have a different agreement between me and Ali and maybe me and Joyce, despite the fact that I'm managing money for the same, you know, we all on the same platform and everything, but different agreements on how to go about managing your account.
Right. That's pretty popular, but the other type of account you talked about was the individual account, right?
Yes, individual account, yes.
What are the advantages and disadvantages, rather, that you could point out to having an individual account as opposed to a managed account?
Well, an individual account means you become your own hedge fund, right? So you're your own managing partner. You have to learn how to actually invest. You have to put in time. It's not an easy job. So you have to learn how it works and why it works the way it works. For instance, you have to know where to put a stop loss. You have to learn how the whole platform works. You have to understand the industry that you're going to invest in, the company, the insiders, what they're doing. Why are they selling? Are they buying? Overall, you have to be your own hedge fund manager or your own fund manager, right? So you have to be very careful on what you want to do with your own amount. The advantage is you have nobody to blame. It's you. So if the account, for instance, you made a loss this year, you cannot say because the market was down or because, I don't know, something happened. You are the only one to blame.
So you sort of have a monopoly of control.
Exactly.
That you get to benefit on the good and the bad on your own account.
On your own account. You have nobody to pay on the other hand, so you find that the expenses might be lower. But you have to learn as well, because you know the market is dynamic, keeps changing, and you have to change with it as well. So you might find maybe something that worked 3-4 years ago, it's not working anymore. Exactly. So you have to change with that and be able to change with the current environment. So those are the disadvantages and advantages. The biggest disadvantage is maybe a stock that goes against you or a position that you held and it goes against you. And, you know, because of the panic, you're looking at that and you're, okay, I'm down 10%. I'm down again 20%. What do I do? Do you average down? Do you sell down the position? What is going to happen? You have to know how to manage your position. Most of people tell you that, you know, long-term investing is there, but you need to learn how to manage the positions you have. How exposed are you, right? So is it 10% of your entire assets? Is it 20%? And you know, the bigger the position, if it goes against you, the bigger, the more red your portfolio is. You could be having, you know, one stock that you heavily invested in and others which are, you know, they make up a very small percentage and it goes against you, you're down. Despite the fact that the rest could be in green territory.
So the advantage is you have ultimate control.
Yeah.
Because you don't have to pay anyone a management fee or a performance fee.
Yes.
You're your own fund manager. And the disadvantage is you get to suffer from your own inexperience.
True. Or your own mistakes.
True, your cash.
So you have to look into what you want to do. I'd say it's a good thing you can just decide what you want to do and go with it. If you're a beginner, you just want to have access to offshore, maybe an ETF might be the best option you first want to do. You get exposed to the offshore markets or the foreign exchanges and all, but the good part is it gives you time to also to learn on how to go about the stock market, the offshore stock market specifically.
Just look at the market in general. What's the balance between individuals,
yeah,
who decide to, you know, own individual accounts versus those who decide to have a fund manager?
Well, individuals don't necessarily do well. I could be biased, that's number one, but in general terms, they're always getting at the wrong time. So when the market is very hot, they want to get in and, you know, buy as much as possibly they can. And that has a disadvantage, in fact, because if it goes against you, it can happen very quickly that you might not be able to have learned how to manage your position. For instance, you probably don't even know how a stop loss works. So you didn't have one and now you're down 50%. You're not sure what you want to do. So the default setting for most is, you know, I'm a long-term investor now because something has gone against you, become the true value long-term investor looking 10 years into the future.
So you become a long-term investor because
precisely
something that you decided to settle on because of the
losses. Yes, you don't want to take the loss and move on. So you want to see at least, can I break even? And you get married to the position. That's the worst part. Now, this is the part where emotions really take, you know, stronghold in your decision making, and it becomes a small loss can end up being a complete wipeout on your account. So it really depends on what you're looking for. Not everybody is active. Not everybody wants to learn how the stock market works, right?
It sounds like something that would definitely require a little time and effort, which is...
Precisely. And most people don't have that. I mean, you have your daily chores to do. You have different things to think about. I mean, the stock market might not be even something you want to even learn or even think about. You just want access to an investment. So you find in Kenya, the only option you have maybe is unit trust. And as you have seen, the returns are not something to write home about, but give or take, I'll still say it's a start, right? So it's just that now you more will be learning that there's access to not just the Kenyan jurisdiction type of investment, there's also offshore investing.
I think this is quite a lot to unpack. When we started the podcast, I thought accounts have very little information, but apparently there is a lot of nitty-gritties to it.
Yes, they are. So it's a process that you need to learn. Take your time, learn about it. Also, try to make sure you understand what is going on. The best would be always make sure that you have access to your account. That is, if, for instance, somebody tells you, you know, we did 25% this year. Is it true? Are you confirming that from your side? Can you see that? Can you see that 25%? Because it will be there, for instance, if you're in Interactive Brokers, you'll be able to access on both sides. The manager is managing your account, but on your side, you're also able to see the holdings he has. Right, so the cash amount that is still on your portfolio. So if he says you own 2,000 shares of Facebook, is that true?
Yeah, but then again, having visibility to your account without control just gives you, you know, the emotions without being able to act on them.
True, but sometimes just let it work, because most of the time I find that, you know, you buy a stock and it's like it was just waiting for you to buy and then it just goes against you for no good reason. And a few other times you will buy at it, you know, the exact time and just blows off, you know, it's up 30%. No, those are the few times. Most of the time is you buy and for no good reason the stock decides, okay, this is the time when I reverse and take a breather from going this high, and the panic selling can happen immediately, and you know, it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy, and those who are well informed can see, wow, okay, this is an opportunity, so you buy into the company.
So the difference between investing individually and in the hardware fund manager is, of course, the access to information, meaningful information.
True.
And the applicability of experience.
Yes. So you need to be able to both learn how to control your emotions. That is actually the hardest part. So you need to know, now the stock has gone against me. Am I supposed to average down? Am I supposed to sell? What am I supposed to do with this thing? Because now I've lost money and I'm not sure what is going on. Do I just leave it and just forget it and say, you know, I tried, it didn't work out, and this is it. This is it for me. Let me just leave and go back to what I'm used to, you know. So there's both those that you need to learn about. You just need to learn about yourself, because every investor, despite anything, the investment that they have is a reflection of who they are, right? So you have to learn to know your weaknesses and your strength. Are you able to control your emotions? Maybe not. Then you might not want to be the one who's actually managing your
Maybe
own
you
account.
Have custodian for your money.
Precisely. But if you're fine, you can look at your account, it's down, you know, 50%, and you're like, okay, that's not bad. You look at it and maybe everything checks out. You can put in more money or just know when to exactly cut your losses as fast as possible. So the idea is cut your losses quick and let your winners run. Has always been the best policy. So it really depends on what you're looking for as an investor, and how sure and confident are you about yourself and the knowledge you have as you get into the offshore stock markets.
I think maybe we should cut today's episode here, because this is quite a lot to unpack, and I want to give our listeners a time to listen to this and then also read about it.
If you have a question, they will be able to reach out and ask as many as they can on how to go about it and learn more about it, because anybody who has interest, they will normally follow up.
For sure. Right, guys, thank you so much for joining in. There's a lot more we need to talk about, so next time we'll delve deeper again into the types of traders as well as the platforms. That was Ray for you. Any last words on where our future investors can find more information?
If you're a beginner, I think you just need to download Yahoo Finance. It's an app that gives you as much information as you possibly can. Now, there's a subscription part, then there's the free part. So just stick to the free part for now. Secondly, if you want to learn more about offshore investing, I do have a group, Kenyans Investing in Offshore Stock Markets. So it's a Facebook group. You can always reach out to us, and we actually have a class which is ongoing. So we try to demystify how offshore investing works to especially the retail investors, but also looking into training for the corporate as well. So it's simply just giving people information on the capability they might have or the alternative they might have on their portfolio formation from just having the Kenyan context on if your assets are all fully in Kenya shillings, might not be the best as usual. So reach out to us, let us know whether you'd like to learn more about offshore investing.
Well, so that's it for you guys. Have a good day. See you in the next episode. Same time.
Same. Saturday 10 a.m. All right. Great.